value for your customers. As a reminder, functional value is accrued by virtue of an offering doing what it was designed to do. So the functional value of soap is that it gets you clean. The functional value of a car is that it gets you from point A to point B. Brands contribute to customer evaluations of functional value by serving as a performance signal. In economics, signal is a term of art. It refers to an easily observable but unimportant attribute that serves as a proxy for a difficult to observe but important attribute. So, if you are buying a car, it is important that you get a car that is reliable. But reliability isn't like color or engine size. It's difficult to observe directly before purchase. Instead, we tend to use brand as a signal of reliability, because the brand is an easy to identify attribute. We know that Honda, for example, is a brand that tends to be correlated with high reliability, which is just a complicated way of saying Honda makes reliable cars. So, brands influence functional value by serving as signals of more important attributes. Monetary value can also be influenced by branding. A brand sets a reference frame for consumers when evaluating prices. If I were to tell you about a Bic brand pen selling for $50, you would probably be shocked and outraged by a pen priced so high. If, on the other hand, I were to tell you that a Mont Blanc pen was selling for $50, that might seem perfectly reasonable, and perhaps even a bargain. But how can that be? I didn't tell you anything about the pen, other than the brand name. You don't know what kind of pen it is, you don't know how well it's made, you don't know how well it writes, but the brand alone was enough to influence your evaluation of that price, thereby affecting the monetary value you would derive from an offering. So, if you want your brand to serve as a signal that can boost functional value, or as a reference frame that will boost monetary value for your customers, what can you do? Well, both of these sources of brand value are based on correlations in the minds of customers. When your brand consistently produces high-quality offerings, or offers consistently low prices, or makes consistently delicious cupcakes, those links are reinforced in memory, and your brand's signal value is improved. If you are not disciplined and consistent in managing the associations your customers have with your brand's signal value will be much weaker. In short, your brand must stand for something. And the way to do that is slow, regular, repetitive communication of a consistent message. Not very sexy, I know, but there it is. Be consistent, be consistent, be consistent. The last two sources of value, social and psychological, are a little more interesting from a marketing perspective. For social value and psychological value, brands don't serve as signals of or reference points for another source of value. Instead, the brands themselves create value for the customers. Social value is the value a brand provides in facilitating relationships with other people. In many situations, a brand can serve as a kind of passkey that lets you into a clique or group. It can provide you with an excuse to talk to someone or as a topic for extended conversations. If you've ever bonded with someone over the car you both drive or the computer you both use or even the sports team or the TV show you both love, you've experienced the social value of brands. Consider the Harley-Davidson brand. If you own a Harley-Davidson, you are immediately admitted to a social group that consists of other Harley-Davidson owners. There are, of course, formal Harley social groups. These include biker gatherings and riding clubs. But even informally, Harley riders look out for each other. I knew a guy in college who owned a Harley. He was a member of a riding club, a group of random men and women who owned Harley-Davidson motorcycles, and they got together periodically just to ride together. Often, they would select a time and a spot at the side of the road to start their ride. So they would agree to meet at 7 p.m. at mile marker 28, and they would just take off from there. Well, on one occasion, this acquaintance of mine was a few minutes early, so he pulled over to wait for the rest of his crew. He told me he was there for less than a minute before another guy on a Harley showed up. "Hey, man, are you okay? Is your bike okay? Do you need any help?" And my friend said, no, everything's fine. I'm just waiting for some friends. Cool, man. Have fun. Within another couple of minutes, a second guy on a Harley pulled over. Hey, man, are you okay? Is your bike okay? My friend said he was there about 5 minutes before his riding club started to show up. And in that time, three strangers on Harleys pulled up to ask him if his bike was okay. That is a real social benefit that accrues to owners of Harley-Davidsons. If your Honda Civic is broken down on the side of the road, nobody cares. There is no secret fraternity of Hyundai Elantra owners. But if you own a Harley, that provides you with a link to other people that often simply wouldn't exist if you were riding another brand of motorcycle. The last type of value a brand can provide is psychological. We're actually going to break this type of value into two categories. Some of the psychological value brands provide is internal. In other words, brands affect how we feel about ourselves. Brands can also provide external psychological value. This is when brands affect how we define ourselves to the world and influence others' perceptions of us. We often refer to this kind of brand value as lifestyle branding. Brands that define a lifestyle we are attempting to create and communicate to others. So, how does Harley-Davidson provide internal psychological value to its customers? Well, think about how you would feel if you were to put on some big black boots and a black Harley-Davidson leather jacket and some dark sunglasses and sit astride a low growling low rider. Yeah. Admit it. You just sneered a little bit, didn't you? You didn't mean to, but just thinking about riding that bike made you a little more aggressive. A little bit more of a tough guy, curled up one side of your lip just a little bit. And that is the power of the Harley-Davidson brand. And Harley-Davidson knows this. It's no accident. Richard Teerlink, the former CEO, put it best. He said, "We give the possibility for a 43-year-old accountant to dress in black leather and ride through town and scare everybody." That is catharsis. People feel something different, actually becoming someone else, at least temporarily, by associating themselves with a brand. Finally, the Harley-Davidson brand also provides external psychological value for some people. People use the brand to communicate something about themselves to others, to define a lifestyle. My aunt used to work at a Harley-Davidson retail store near Gary, Indiana. And I remember her telling me once, she was shocked at how much of their business came from women. Women who didn't own a Harley. These women would plunk down for shirts and jackets, scarves and hats, all emblazoned with the Harley-Davidson logo. Not apparently because they loved the bike and wanted to express that love. Instead, they were wearing Harley-Davidson brand to allow them to communicate something that they wanted other people to know about them. Like, maybe they were tough ladies or a little wild or something. So, we have these different sources of value that brands can create or reinforce for customers. And there is a common belief among marketing managers that it's better to build a brand around social value or psychological value than around functional value or monetary value. In fact, in some circles, these various sources of value are ordered from most concrete, that would be the functional value, through monetary value and social value, up to the most abstract source of value, the psychological value associated with self-definition and lifestyle communication. People describe this as the branding ladder and speak of the virtues of moving up the ladder from more concrete benefits to more abstract benefits. It's certainly not hard to think of successful brands that started as functional and moved up the ladder over time. Puma, Swatch, Timberland, Patagonia, Nike, all of these brands initially positioned themselves in terms of functional superiority relative to competitors. But over time, they moved into a space where they could serve as a source of psychological value for customers. Apple's Macintosh computers were initially positioned on their ease of use, a functional source of value. But the brand's value evolved to a lifestyle positioning over time, to the point where they ran an ad campaign in which someone proclaimed, "I am a Mac." Dove is another example. Dove started with a functional branding. The benefits it offered were soft, hydrated skin. In fact, the original positioning was not just around a functional benefit. They went so far as to tell you the exact proportion of the ingredient that delivered the benefit in their advertising. Dove is made with 1/4 moisturizing cream. That is a brand strategy that emphasizes functional value. Then, Dove started moving up the ladder with their Real Beauty campaign. With these ads, which were designed to pit Dove as a woman's ally against the rest of the beauty industrial complex, emphasized true, imperfect beauty over airbrushed, unattainable, unrealistic portrayals of beauty. Dove was seeking to establish itself as a source of psychological value. Dove would become a part of how you defined yourself, both internally and externally. It's easy to see why marketing managers would see moving up the ladder as a good thing. Functional attributes are more concrete and so more open to blatant attacks. If you use 1/4 moisturizing cream in your soap, perhaps a competitor will come along that uses 1/3. If your filter gets water 99.9% clean, perhaps a competitor will come along with a filter that cleans to a 99.99 standard. You create 8-minute abs, a competitor comes along to create 7-minute abs. More abstract social or psychological sources of value are usually harder to make substantive claims against. It would be harder to convince someone who likes Dove that your soap was in fact more empowering for women, for example. So, some marketers see psychological or lifestyle branding as a more defensive positioning, and so a better place for a brand to be. And while there are certainly advantages to lifestyle branding, let me add one word of caution. This is actually an area in which I've published some of my own research. Some colleagues and I investigated the scope of competition related to lifestyle brands, and we found they're not nearly as unassailable as they might seem at first. To understand the potential downside of building a lifestyle brand, we have to first understand why consumers would value a brand that provides psychological value like that. The answer is that lifestyle brands, just like all other kinds of brands, create value by meeting a customer need. In the case of lifestyle brands, that need is the need to self-express. And that can be a powerful need. But there are three important things to realize about this need to self-express. First, this need is not a constant need. It fluctuates over time depending on what consumers are doing and how they're feeling. Sometimes the need to self-express is very strong. Other times, particularly right after customers have expressed themselves in some way, the need to self-express is weaker. The second thing to acknowledge about the need to self-express is that consumers now have more opportunities to express themselves than they have ever had before. You can self-express through brands, of course, but you can also express yourself through your politics or your hobbies. You can take mass-produced goods like your computer or your phone and then customize them by changing the wallpaper or the ringtone. You can go on social media and express yourself to hundreds or thousands of friends and strangers. The third thing to remember about self-expression is that the need to self-express is not limited to a particular product category. You do not have one need to self-express through your car and a separate, independent need to express yourself through your clothing, and then another, alternative need to self-express through your entertainment choices. The need to self-express is a single, unitary need that can be stated in any number of different ways. Taken together, these three insights suggest that there are some dangers to lifestyle branding, in addition to the benefits. When moving away from a functional positioning for your brand, you allow yourself to serve a more fundamental customer need. But you also open yourself up to cross-category competition from any other brand that is trying to serve the same need. You're no longer just fighting for a share of sales in a particular category, but a share of the customer's identity. So, that's branding. Remember, as with everything else in marketing, take your customer's perspective when thinking about your brand. Don't just think about your branding elements, the logo and so on, but also consider the associations your customers are likely to have with your brand. Manage those associations. And finally, consider the different sources of value customers can derive from your brand. Determine what sources of value, functional, monetary, social, or psychological, you want to convey to your customers through your brand. Doing this will ensure that you create a brand that customers will connect with, that will simultaneously make your offering more valuable and defend it from competition.
This lecture is titled Customer-Focused Pricing.
One of the most important decisions you will make in marketing is how to price your product or service. So, how do we settle on a price? Well, there are three basic types of information you'll need to set a price that will jointly maximize value for you and for your customer. The first piece of information is internal. What are the costs associated with making and selling the offering? Cost information is important because unless you've carefully tracked your costs, you could end up accidentally selling your product at a loss. Don't laugh, it happens. Granted, there are a few settings in which it may make sense to lose money on some sales, but those settings are relatively rare and always part of a larger strategy in which sales of other offerings make up for those losses. If not, the company tends to not stick around for very long. So, it is always important to track costs carefully and to consider costs when setting a price. We in marketing tip our hats to the fine folks in accounting who do that hard work. Tracking costs can be tricky, and good cost numbers are invaluable. However, even though cost information is important to have, when you consider everything that goes into smart pricing decisions, it turns out that costs are among the least important bits of information. Cost information sets a floor on what prices are possible for the firm. But your costs tell you nothing about how your customer will evaluate your prices. This brings us to the second type of information you will need to set your prices, your competitors' prices. Competitors' prices are an important source of information because your competitors' prices are important inputs for your customers as they evaluate the attractiveness of your price. But let me give you two pieces of advice about using competitors' prices to help you set your own. First, the relative importance of competitors' prices will depend on the type of market you're in and the type of product or service you're selling. If you are in a market with lots of competitors, and it's very easy for your customers to compare prices, think airline tickets or jars of peanut butter, then keeping up with your competitors' prices will be extremely important because your customer will almost certainly be using that information to evaluate your price. On the other hand, if you are in an industry where it's difficult to compare prices across suppliers or where offerings are highly differentiated, making it difficult to make apples-to-apples comparisons between offerings, well, then up-to-the-minute tracking of competitors' prices will be relatively less important in determining your pricing strategy. The second piece of advice about analyzing your competitors' prices is this. Make sure you are using the right set of competitors. Your competitive set should not be determined by any kind of market designation. For example, not subcompact cars or liquid hand soaps. Your competitive set should not simply be other brands in your category, as defined by major retailers or distributors. Instead, your competitive set should always be defined by your customers. What other options are your customers making comparisons to when they are considering your product? If there are certain brands in the same category that your customers would never consider buying, then those brands are not in your competitive set, and their prices are irrelevant. This also means that your competitive set could span traditional categories if your customers consider options across categories as substitutes. To illustrate, imagine you were trying to price a live music venue. You shouldn't look to the prices of anywhere in town that plays live music, from the symphony to the corner bar to the sports stadium hosting a U2 concert. Your competition is not the product category of live music. Your competitive set is whatever your target customer would consider substitutes for the goods and services you provide? Would your customers be choosing between going to your live music venue or going to the theater to see a play? Well, then that's a better competitive set for you. Or if your targets are choosing between your venue and an evening at a karaoke bar. Remember, your competition is determined by your customers. So far, we've considered two bits of information: the costs involved in creating the product and the competitors' prices. The third, and by far the most important type of information to consider when setting your price, is the value your customers place on your offering. Ultimately, your customer's opinion of how much your offering is worth is the most important thing. Costs are important to know so you don't go broke, and competitors' prices are important to know because they'll often establish reference points for your customers' evaluations. But ultimately, your goal is to price your products in such a way that your customer thinks what you're selling is worth what you're asking for it. That's the most important lesson in pricing. Know who your customers are and price according to what they see in your offering. Of course, sometimes you have more than one target customer that you're selling to, and those groups of customers may value the offerings differently. This can be a problem. If one group is willing to pay $2 for your widget and another is willing to pay $1, what do you do? If you want to sell to both groups, you'd have to price at $1 and just leave all that extra money on the table, right? Sometimes, yes. You would just have to lose out on that extra profit and on some sales in order to secure a larger number of sales overall. But sometimes it is possible to identify barriers in the marketplace that differentiate customer groups according to when, where, and how they buy. And once you've identified those barriers, it's often possible to charge these two groups different prices for the same or for substantially similar offerings. This practice of charging different groups of people different prices is generally known as price discrimination. Let me give you some examples to illustrate what I mean. Have you ever wondered why, at least historically, flights over a weekend are so much less expensive than flights during the week? The answer is price discrimination. Airlines are trying to serve two broad customer groups simultaneously: leisure travelers and business travelers. One of these groups tends to be much less price sensitive than the other. In general, people are much more price sensitive when they're spending their own money on a vacation than when they're spending the company's money to visit that account in Akron. Airlines recognize this difference and try to discriminate between these two groups of customers. They quickly realize that business travelers have a strong preference for making it home for the weekend. In contrast, leisure travelers, who are much more price sensitive, will typically seek out trips over the weekends. So, airlines had a barrier, a means of separating the price sensitive customers from the less price sensitive ones, and they priced accordingly. Examples of price discrimination abound. You pay a drastically lower price for a magazine delivered monthly to your door than you do for picking it up at the rack, sometimes just pennies on the dollar. Why? Because magazine publishers have found that those who plan ahead and read regularly tend to be more price sensitive than those who are stuck in an airport terminal and just looking to kill time. My favorite example of price discrimination is probably apocryphal. I've looked for evidence that this really happened, and I can't find it anywhere. I'm not able to confirm it. But I'll share it anyway because it illustrates the principle well, even if it's most likely just marketing folklore. The story goes that a company that made pregnancy tests realized that there were two segments that were buying its offering. One group was aspiring to get pregnant and purchased the tests in anticipation of joyous news. The other group was terrified and would view a positive test as a distinctly negative outcome. This company further found that these groups differed in their price sensitivity and, importantly, where in the grocery store they tended to go to look first for a pregnancy test. Those that were dreading a pregnancy tended to look for tests among the prophylactics and tended to look for the cheapest option they thought would give them an accurate result. In contrast, those that were hoping to get pregnant tended to look for the tests among the baby food and the diapers and such. They were willing to spend much more on the tests. So, armed with this market research, this company made two nearly identical versions of their pregnancy test. One had plain clinical packaging and sold for a low price among the prophylactics. The other featured colorful packaging with cheerful, chubby babies and was sold for much more among the baby stuff. When price discrimination happens over time, it's sometimes called price skimming. Electronics companies do this all the time. They know there is a small group of customers who want the latest, greatest gadgets and want to be the first to get them. They will camp out for new releases. They want bragging rights over their friends for having the biggest, the fastest, the newest. So firms will happily charge this group of early adopters a premium in order to get it first. Then they'll slowly drop the price over time to appeal to those who would like a bigger TV or a faster computer, but are not willing to sell their birthright in order to get it first. Given the importance of price in driving consumer decision-making, firms often have a strong inclination to lower their prices. After all, dropping price will almost always increase sales. I would encourage you to fight this urge. There are several dangers associated with competing on price. One danger of low price is inciting a price war. The amazing thing about a price war is that people are always convinced that it's the other guy's fault. In fact, one survey found that among firms that reported being in a price war, fully 88% believed it was the competition's fault. That's right. Almost 90% of companies insist it was the other guy that started the price war. Now, I'm no statistician, but really? There's a professor at the Wharton School named David Rebstein who's done a lot of research into what causes price wars. One of his favorite things to do when teaching executives is to bring them into a networked computer lab to play a simple pricing game. Each of these senior managers sits at a computer and competes anonymously with two other people in the room. Each round, all three players set a price and then make a couple of other basic marketing decisions. Then they receive feedback on how each of them performed in that round: sales, revenue, profit, and so on. And what Professor Rebstein finds again and again is that these senior executives, these people who should know better, consistently engage in price wars, driving prices down lower and lower every round. He says it's even happened on more than one occasion that one of these frustrated execs will jump up in the lab and shout, "All right, whoever the idiot is who keeps lowering their price, cut it out. You're ruining it for everyone." What these managers don't know until after the game ends is that they were not, in fact, playing against each other. Instead, they were all playing against the computer. And the two fake competitors run by the computer followed two very simple pricing rules. One bot priced randomly, every round, just drew a price out of a hat. And the other simply took your price from last round and went 5% lower. That's it. That's all it took to start a price war against a real executive. I find that there is a common belief among my MBA students about dropping price. They tend to believe that there exists some magic price point that's low enough that they'll attract customers, but not so low that the competition will react to it. Let me be very clear. That price does not exist. If lowering your price is driving customers from your competitor to you, your competitor will react. And often, the easiest, fastest, least risky way for them to respond is to simply lower their price to match your drop. And now, we've got a price war. Your competition will always be more sensitive to your price changes than will be your customers. If your competitive strategy involves lowering your prices, be sure that you anticipate how your competitors might react. And if you find yourself thinking, "They're too smart to start a price war with us," that would be bad for them too. Stop what you're doing. They're not too smart to do that. No offense, but they're no smarter than you are. The only way to win a price war is if you have the lowest cost structure in your competitive set. If you do, you can sustain lower costs over the long haul. So if you are the Walmart of your industry, if you have super lean operations and the most efficient logistics, then by all means, pursue a low price strategy. But if you don't have significant cost advantages, then trying to win on price is a losing proposition. Try differentiating your product, or focusing on branding, or changing up your distribution. But don't compete on price unless you have an advantage on cost. One of the justifications for lowering prices is to attract new customers. This is the second danger of low prices. If you must lower your prices to attract customers, you're probably failing somewhere else in your marketing. Usually, it means you haven't done your targeting and positioning correctly. Essentially, when you lower your prices to attract customers, you are paying customers to buy your product. You're buying customers who are not your target customers. And these customers will overwhelmingly be disloyal customers. Think of the sad lesson of Groupon and other large discount couponing companies. For a couple of years, the Groupons of the world were hailed as the future of marketing. They were the hottest business model going. Customers would sign up and get periodic offers for massive discounts on restaurants and spa treatments and hot air balloon rides. Many companies jumped at the chance to get these new customers through their doors to try their offerings. But companies changed their tunes relatively quickly. They discovered that these coupon customers came in, used their discounts, and then they would leave and never come back. And why should they? These people tended to be bargain hunters. They were willing to buy your offering at 50 cents on the dollar, but why would they come back later and pay full price when they could go to some other restaurant or some spa and get the same one-time deal from then? Basically, there are only two types of companies for which it makes sense to use a Groupon-type service. One is companies who have margins that are so high they can still turn a profit when they sell at half off, which is great work if you can get it. The other case is if your offering is so clearly, obviously, massively superior to anything else that just trying it once will convince customers that they should come back later, regardless of the price. So basically, if you're selling heroin, this works as a business model. If you're selling sandwiches, not so much. The last danger of pricing low is the quality inferences customers make based on price. The fact that people tend to associate lower priced options with lower quality is well known. But not many marketers realize just how powerful this tendency can be. Let's look at some research that illustrates just how strongly price influences people's judgments about quality. In one study, people were stopped as they were going into a gym and offered a can of Twin Lab Ultra Fuel. This is an energy drink that claims to improve endurance and thus make workouts more intense. Randomly, people were offered the drink either at the full retail price of $2.89 or they were offered it at a discount of 89 cents. Later, after they had finished their exercise, those gym-goers who had consumed the energy drink filled out a survey on which they indicated how intense that workout had been relative to their typical session. Surprisingly, people who had bought the drink at the low price actually reported having a less intense workout than normal, while those who had bought it at full price reported their workouts were more intense than usual. The same research team ran another study using a more objective performance measure. In this experiment, participants were sold a bottle of Sobe Adrenaline Rush, a drink that claims to improve mental acuity and concentration. Again, some participants were sold the drink at full price, and some were sold the drink at a steep discount. After consuming the beverage and learning of the product claims, all participants were given a number of challenging puzzles to solve. Remarkably, participants who had bought the drink on sale performed worse than those who had bought it at full price, This was exactly the same drink, just bought at a lower price. The link between price and perceived quality can be very powerful. The final thing to understand about prices is that customers are often not nearly as well informed about prices as many marketers assume they are. In one groundbreaking study, Peter Dixon from Ohio State University and Alan Sawyer from the University of Florida conducted an extensive survey of grocery store shoppers. Dixon and Sawyer stationed survey takers in grocery aisles, so they appeared to be shopping or taking inventory. These individuals would wait until a customer had selected some product, and then immediately after they'd put it in their basket, the worker would explain they were conducting a survey and would ask consumers if they could, without looking, tell them the price of the item they had just selected. The results were astonishing. 21% of those surveyed wouldn't even guess the price. Another 32% ventured a guess, but they were off by more than 15%. That means when asked right after placing something in their cart, fewer than half of the shoppers surveyed were able to report an even somewhat accurate guess as to the price of what they had just chosen. Some people have interpreted these results to mean that price doesn't matter, that consumers don't pay attention to or don't care about price. I don't think that's right. Prices clearly matter. But I think we do have some reason to question the assumption that consumers are always well informed about prices, that consumers always have accurate, up-to-date reference prices that they can draw on to make comparisons and evaluations. So, how are people evaluating prices if they don't have a master list of price expectations for every product or service that they encounter? There are two alternative paths customers have for evaluating prices. One is to compare the prices of readily available items. So, customers may not know exactly how much that Hamilton Beach blender should cost, but by comparing its price with the prices of all the other blenders on the store shelf, they can start to form an idea of whether the price of the Hamilton Beach is attractive or not. This is known as using external reference prices, or as using the local decision context to evaluate prices. And let me note a couple of basic principles for managing context-based price comparisons. First, marketers need to be aware of the general principle of extremeness aversion. There are exceptions, but as a rule, customers tend to avoid both the most expensive and the least expensive options in a category. At many restaurants, the best-selling wine is the second least expensive wine on the menu. And when bidding out projects, some companies implement the policy of throwing out the highest and the lowest bid offered, considering only the best of the remaining bids in the middle. For this reason, firms often offer products at the highest or lowest points they know are unlikely to sell well. By having those very high or very low offerings available, they're making their remaining products seem more moderately priced, thereby increasing the sales of those offerings. The second basic principle for managing a context-based price comparison is that people tend to use the context to gauge their reference prices relative to other people. In other words, if you are buying binoculars and you have a range of prices to choose from, you might pick a pair by asking yourself, how serious of a bird watcher am I relative to the entire population of bird watchers? If your answer is, I'm only a casual bird watcher, I don't care that much, then you'll probably select one of the lower priced models available. On the other hand, if you say to yourself, I am way more serious about this than most people, then you'll probably select one of the more expensive options available. So far, so good. But it turns out that people often are too focused on whatever prices they happen to see at the moment and are insensitive to whether that set of prices reflects all of the prices on the market. Researchers from MIT and the University of Rochester demonstrated this effect empirically by asking people to imagine that it had started raining and they needed to buy a poncho to keep themselves dry. The poncho vendor had three lengths available, 32 inches, 34 inches, and 36 inches. Which poncho would you buy? As part of the survey, they also asked people to give their height. And when they compared these two answers, they found that short people tended to choose the 32-inch poncho, medium-sized people tended to choose the 34, and tall people chose the 36. But here's where things got interesting. The researchers gave a different group of people another version of the survey in which the poncho lengths ranged from 34 to 38 inches. And then they gave another group a version in which the lengths ranged from 36 to 40. And still another that ranged from 38 to 42. In every case, regardless of the actual lengths available, short people chose the shortest, medium-sized people went for the middle option, and tall people chose the longest. So how long are rain ponchos in reality? Most are between 50 and 52 inches long. So these were all comically short ponchos, like miniskirt ponchos. Had people known the full range of what was available on the market, everyone would have chosen the longest poncho available, because even the longest poncho would have been short of the typical length. But because most people don't know how long a poncho should be, they performed this preference matching procedure, asking themselves, how tall am I relative to other people? Well, then I should probably get the poncho that corresponds to my place in the height distribution. People often behave the same way with prices. They will choose the price level of the offering based on the assumption that the local set matches the overall distribution of preferences in the market. If I am a moderately discerning audiophile, then I should choose a moderately priced pair of headphones from the set available at this store, even if it turns out that all of the headphones at this store are relatively high priced. The last thing we're going to talk about with regards to pricing is price image. Price image is where pricing intersects with branding. A price image is your reputation for pricing, which may or may not be in line with your actual pricing relative to your competitors. Walmart has a low price image. Whole Foods has a high price image. Price image can affect consumers' evaluations of prices in an interesting way. With my colleague Oleg Erminsky at the University of Chicago, I've conducted a series of experiments looking at how consumers use price image. And what we found is that often, when consumers don't have a well-defined reference price for a particular product, they will just assume that a price that they encounter is consistent with a retailer's price image. So, for example, we showed consumers a carton of Tropicana orange juice being sold at either Whole Foods or at Jewel Osco. It's a grocery store in Chicago with a moderate price image. We used the same price for both stores. So we showed people the carton and asked them to evaluate that price. And when people thought they were seeing the price at Whole Foods, they evaluated it as a high price. When they thought they were seeing the price at Jewel Osco, they evaluated exactly the same price as being much lower and more attractive. The lesson for Whole Foods is that even if their prices are objectively competitive, customers are likely to assume the prices are high based just on its price image. So why does this matter to marketers? Well, a store's price image should be managed like a brand image. In other words, price images are not formed based just on a store's objective prices. Rather, consumers also use lots of non-price cues when forming a price image, including the store's decor, its location, the level of service provided, the quality of its merchandise, and so on. Price images are best managed not just by managing prices, but by managing all the price-related associations consumers might form with the brand. So that's pricing, in a nutshell. There are lots of rules to follow and a few things to remember. But if there's one thing you should take away from this lecture, it's this. Remember that pricing is never objectively good or bad. All pricing should be specific to a particular target market and geared toward maximizing the value for that segment of customers. It always all comes down to knowing who is your customer and what do they value.
This lecture is titled Marketing Communications That Work.
The time has come for us to talk about communications. Communications is a tactic, and so, as with all of our other tactics, we should not even attempt to make decisions about how, when, or where to communicate until after we've settled on a strategy. This includes choosing a target customer and positioning our offering to suit that customer. Only after we have a strategy in place does it make sense to start designing an ad campaign, or posting billboards, or sending out direct mail catalogs, or doing any of the other things we can do to communicate with our customers. Strategy always precedes tactics. Some of you may be surprised to find that we are only just now, in Lecture 10, finally getting around to talking about advertising. But the placement of our discussion of advertising within this course is actually a reasonable proxy for its relative importance in marketing decision-making. Because advertising is so visible, many people mistakenly assume advertising constitutes most of marketing. That's simply not true. When marketing is done well, it starts well before any particular communication program is even conceived. It incorporates product design, pricing, distribution, and incentives. So despite the fact that advertising is often the most visible, most creative, entertaining, memorable, occasionally even brilliant part of marketing, it's also a relatively small part of marketing. Good marketing encompasses much more than just advertising. With all that said, communication is still important. So let's talk about some of the principles involved in doing marketing communications well. The process of communicating is fun and interesting because it's actually a microcosm of the marketing process itself. Just as you need a marketing plan that includes a specific goal, a strategy to reach that goal, and a set of tactics designed to implement that strategy, so also each communication effort requires its own communication plan, complete with its own communications goal, its own strategy, and its own tactics. Let's walk through the process of creating a communications plan by looking at one example of a particularly successful campaign, the California Milk Processor Board's Got Milk campaign. First, let's set the stage. In the late 1980s and early 90s, per capita consumption of milk declined by about 2 gallons per year. That's a pretty significant drop, and it translated to about $50 million in lost profit for the industry in California. As you can imagine, milk producers were very concerned. They tried to diagnose what was the problem here. Milk's advertising in the late 80s was targeted at kids and teens and delivered the message that milk was healthy. Milk was good for strong bones and a great smile and beautiful skin. One set of ads featured preteens holding a glass of milk and talking to someone who was the source of some sort of anxiety or insecurity, like a bully or a romantic crush. As the kid spoke, he or she aged in stages until they became a young adult. So the bullies were warned that though the protagonist may be small now, he was drinking milk, and so someday he would be big and strong. Sure enough, as he was talking, he grew into a strapping 19-year-old who towered over his potential tormentors. In another spot, a girl was addressing an indifferent boy, telling him that though she may not be much to look at now, she was drinking milk, which meant that in a few years she would be beautiful. True to her word, she transforms before our eyes into a stunning 20-year-old beauty. So that was the message. Kids, teens, whatever your physical insecurities are, milk will fix them. It'll make you big, strong, beautiful, and popular. And the thing is, it kind of worked. People actually seemed to believe the message. In survey research conducted by the Milk Processor Board, 89% of respondents agreed with the statement, "Milk is a healthy drink." Furthermore, a fully 80% reported that they liked the taste of milk. So what was the problem? If pretty much everyone likes it, and pretty much everyone thinks it's healthy, why were people buying less of it? That gets us to the first part of our communication plan. Before you run any kind of customer communication initiative, you should know exactly what is the goal for your communications. Is it an awareness campaign? Do you just want to let people know that you exist or to keep the brand top of mind? Is it an informative campaign? Are you trying to educate people on some new offering or new feature? Is it a persuasive campaign? Are you trying to change attitudes or convince people of something? What are you trying to accomplish with your communications? The goal of your communications campaign should be consonant with your larger goal of the overall marketing plan, but it's usually more specific, more targeted. The milk processors did some good market research, and they determined that although there were many possible reasons for the decline in milk consumption, including increased competition from other types of beverages, changes in the way people were consuming drinks at this time, they zeroed in on one problem that they thought they could actually address through advertising. Rationing. Turns out that milk is consumed differently than a lot of other beverages. Because it's usually purchased 1 gallon at a time and shared across an entire household, consumption of milk is highly sensitive to how much milk is on hand. If there's a lot in the fridge, people tend to drink a lot. If there's just a little left, people drink it more sparingly. To a certain extent, this is true of anything we consume. The first half of a bottle of shampoo will be used more quickly than the second half. Right after you've purchased a 10-pack of paper towels, you will consider yourself to be rich in the ways of paper towels. You will happily spool off half a roll to handle a small spill. You'll be giving paper towels away as presents to friends. But when you're down to just a few sheets, then you'll start tearing off just a corner. You don't need a full sheet for that job, do you? So rationing describes consumption patterns of many products, but it's especially true for milk, because no one wants to be the one who uses the last of the milk and leaves mom with nothing for her cereal in the morning. Given its importance and the relative ease of addressing it through advertising, rationing was the behavior the milk processor board wanted to change. And how do you combat rationing? Well, by making sure people always have plenty of milk on hand. There's no need to dial back consumption if there's always a plentiful supply of milk in the fridge. So this became the goal of the new communications campaign, which started in 1993. Manage rationing by reminding people to always pick up milk every time they go to the store. Remember that I said a campaign needs not just a goal, but also a strategy. Just like the larger marketing strategy, this includes a target and a positioning. Now, in some cases, the target for a communications campaign will just be the target for the marketing campaign. That's fine. But it doesn't have to be the same. Sometimes you'll communicate to just a subsegment of your total target. Some very popular products, like milk, have several target markets that they're trying to reach. A campaign could try to reach all of those targets, or you could communicate to just one of those groups. Recall that the previous campaign had targeted kids and teens. These are the primary consumers of milk, so they represent a perfectly fine target for the campaign. But they're not the only possible target. If the goal of your campaign was to remind people to buy milk when they're at the store, then a better target might be the parents, those who purchase most of the milk, rather than the kids who drink most of it. There was also a positioning for this campaign, in that it promoted a simple message highlighting an advantage of milk over competitive beverages. For this campaign, the Milk Processors Board settled on milk as the perfect complement for other foods, especially things like cereals, cake, cookies, and sandwiches. That was milk's positioning for this campaign. So, now we have a goal, and we have a strategy. It's time for some tactical decisions. How are we going to get this message to our target? Tactics here included an award-winning series of what came to be known as the deprivation ads. In each ad, someone was enjoying some kind of delicious food, birthday cake or peanut butter sandwich, only to discover, too late, that they had run out of milk, and thus their joy turned to sadness. Each ad, of course, ends with the tagline, "Got milk," which in this context is really a warning not to let the same fate befall you. In one particularly clever ad, a jerky businessman type is seen shoving his way down a crowded sidewalk, obnoxiously yelling into his cell phone that somebody on the other end was fired. He steps out into the street without looking and is immediately flattened by a truck. We next see him in an all-white room, beautifully appointed with luxurious finishes. A soothing voice says, "Welcome to eternity." Confused but happy, the man sees an enormous plate of chocolate chip cookies, and he tucks right in. As he's munching on cookies, He walks over to an oversized fridge and finds it stocked with milk cartons. He laughs and shouts, "I'm in heaven." He opens the first milk carton and tries to pour it into his mouth, only to discover that it's empty. Shrugs, mildly annoyed, picks up another, but he finds that that one's empty too. Now he starts to get desperate, frantically ripping empty milk cartons out of the refrigerator, searching for one that still has milk in it. The commercial ends with a close-up shot of the defeated man's face. He has climbed nearly all the way into the refrigerator, and he has a sudden moment of clarity, empty milk carton clutched in each hand. "Wait a minute," he says. "Where am I?" The ad cuts to a black screen where the Got Milk tagline is crackling in flames. It's a brilliant ad, and the message is very simple. Not having milk on hand can turn heaven into hell. The ads were a roaring success. In the context of this steep decline in milk sales, the campaign actually reversed the drop, causing a 3% increase in sales in California where the ads were run. That's a $30 million difference. The campaign was so successful in California that the National Milk Processors Board picked them up and ran them nationwide. But the success was short-lived. There are probably several reasons for the reversal back to declining sales. Let me suggest one possible reason. The Got Milk slogan continued to be used for years, but the campaign very quickly lost its focus. When the ads rolled out nationally, there was a companion print campaign. You may remember the milk mustache pictures on billboards and in magazines and newspapers. These ads used the same Got Milk tagline, but the message was very different. These ads were not designed to get you to remember to buy milk when you go to the store. That was not the goal of these new ads. The positioning was not that milk makes the perfect complement to other foods, and you'd be really sorry if you didn't always have some on hand. If you remember the milk mustache ads, they featured athletes and models and actors who were promoting the health and beauty benefits of milk. Strong bones and muscles, beautiful skin, nice smile. Basically, it was the same message milk had been communicating in the 80s. And the results were largely the same. People believed the messaging, but they failed to buy the product. The problem was not with the tactics. The creative on that campaign was brilliant. The milk mustache ads rightly won many advertising awards. But even though it was great advertising, it wasn't great marketing because the goal and the strategy were wrong. Brilliant ads do you no good unless you reach your marketing objectives. So, let's pause here and review what we've learned. Organize it into another tool we can put into our marketing toolbox. We'll call this tool the communications plan. When designing a marketing communications plan, it is best to follow a set of discrete steps. First, establish a goal for the communication. The goal should be consistent with the larger marketing goal, but it's usually more specific. We've talked briefly about some of the goals a campaign could have. Awareness, persuasion, brand building. These are all common goals for a communications effort. Presumably, the goal of nearly any communications campaign is to increase sales. But there are different ways to get there. A campaign designed to convince consumers that your offering is better will likely have to include more information and more comparisons to existing offerings than what a campaign designed to create awareness of a new product, for example. So the first step is to know exactly what you hope to accomplish with your communications. The second step is to develop a communication strategy. Again, this parallels your marketing strategy, but it's usually more specific. Who is the target or targets for this communication? What is the positioning of the product or service in these ads? In other words, what specific benefits are being promoted here? The third step is to determine the tactics. As with the overall marketing plan, the tactics in a communication plan should only be determined after the strategy. Should this be a TV campaign or a print or billboards or online or some combination? Should it be interactive or static? Should there be a viral or a social component? How much should we spend? All of these are tactical questions and should only be answered after you know your goal and your target and your positioning. The biggest danger in developing a marketing communication is to get too caught up in the creative. The images used, the actors cast, the innovativeness or cleverness of the copy. The most important thing to remember about communicating with your customers is that those communications should always serve a specific marketing purpose. They should help you achieve some specific marketing goal. Marketing communications is not a test to see who can be the most creative. Creativity can sometimes be a great way to achieve your marketing goal, but it should never be an end to itself. Creativity and cleverness are not sufficient. They're only valuable to the extent they fit within the marketing plan. The last thing I want to talk about is attention. One of the keys to successful communications is commanding the attention of those watching or listening, and doing so without turning them off. Thankfully, we are mostly past the days of flashing banner ads and blaring, fast-talking, mindlessly repetitive commercials. It's not hard to get someone's attention. You could punch them in the face, for example. But if you want to inform or persuade them once you have their attention, you should do so in a way that makes them not hate you. There are a couple of basic ways to encourage people to pay attention to communications. One is to always have news. If your commercials are always informing customers of something that's important, or at least that seems important or interesting at first glance, they're more likely to pay attention to you. If this is a new communication that doesn't really say anything the customer didn't already know, well, why should they pay attention? One way to ensure that you always have new information to share is to employ a strategy of what I call trivial innovation. There are several beer brands that have perfected this strategy. They don't actually change the recipe of the beer. The specter of New Coke casts a long shadow over the marketing profession. But they will change almost anything else about the product in order to have some bit of news to crow about in their ads. Trivial innovation is the preferred communication strategy of the Miller Coors Company. Miller Lite, for example, promoted a beer bottle that had rifling, grooves carved along the inside of the neck of the bottle that caused the beer to twist as it came out in order to, and I'm being serious here, allow for a smoother pour. They called it the Vortex bottle, and it didn't last very long. Later, Miller Lite introduced a punch-top beer can. You can open the can with a tab, as per usual, but then there's a second tab elsewhere on the top of the can. This innovation permits air to flow into the can as the beer comes out, which also allows for a smoother pour. It seems that Miller Lite drinkers had previously faced a very serious problem with unsmooth beer pouring. Luckily, the scientists at Miller Lite had worked tirelessly to fix this problem for them. The scientists at Coors Light, also part of the Miller Coors family, were working on a different problem. Apparently, there's a class of beer drinkers who want to know whether their beer is cold without going to all the trouble of, you know, reaching out and actually touching the can. These beer drinkers are willing to get up from the couch, walk to the kitchen, open the fridge, look inside to see the beer, but that is where they draw the line. They have done enough at that point and will do no more. Must they go through the further indignity of reaching out to actually touch the beer to see if it's cold? Haven't they done enough at that point? Who will hear their plaintive cry? Coors Light solved this problem with cold-activated cans and bottles. When the beer is dropped below a certain temperature, part of the label changes colors, letting you know, without touching, that your beer is cold enough to drink. They even took it a step further. After promoting their cold-activated containers for a while, they introduced windows into their cases. So the cardboard box holding a 12-pack now has holes cut in the side, so you can better see the cold-activated cans inside. They ran ads promoting this. Our boxes now have holes in them. Our containers are now 7% less structurally sound. Buy our beer. None of these technological breakthroughs actually solves a real problem that any beer drinker has ever actually complained about. I mean, really. But these trivial innovations do serve a purpose. They give the beer brand something to talk about in their ads. After all, they could talk about the quality of their hops or the clear Colorado mountain spring water they use. But they've been talking about that for decades. Why should someone bother to pay attention just to hear the same thing all over again? But if you tell me your bottles now have rifling grooves that create a vortex when I pour, yes, it's crazy, but you've got my attention. I'm listening because I'm intrigued. Confused, but intrigued. I enjoy poking fun at MillerCoors for this, but it's actually a perfectly viable strategy for well-established brands. When a brand is new, there's typically lots of news, explaining what an offering is, and telling people what it does. But at some point, customers know the basics of what you're selling. What do you do then? Well, trivial innovation is one way that you can maintain attention. We can look to Budweiser for an example of a different strategy for getting customers' attention. Budweiser tends not to engage in as much trivial innovation for their products and packaging. Instead, they produce ads that are destination entertainment that still promote the brand well. Think of Spuds McKenzie, or the Budweiser Frogs, or the Wazzup guys. Budweiser creates cultural phenomena that people will want to watch because it's entertaining, but that people will also want to talk to their friends about. Budweiser ads are always carefully and closely tied to the brand, and that's very important. But consumers pay attention because the ads often become a kind of conversational currency, something you ask your friends if they've seen so that you can both laugh about it together later. That's their way of convincing people to pay attention. There won't be any news.